Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day in 1271. The emperor of the Mongolian Empire at the time, Kublai Khan, would rename his empire the Yuan Empire, thus beginning the Yuan Dynasty. In 1917, on this day, Finland would have its independence recognized by the Soviet government. 1956, on this day, Japan would be admitted to the United Nations. 1989, on this day, Athol Fugard's My Children, My Africa would premiere in New York City. In 1993, on this day, MGM Grand would open in Las Vegas, being the largest hotel complex in the world at the time. Interestingly enough, it is no longer the largest hotel complex in modern day. From 2020, the First World Hotel in Malaysia is the largest complex. However, the MGM Grand does retain the title of the largest single hotel building in Las Vegas, with more than 5,100 rooms in one building. 2002, Calvin Klein sold his business for $430 million. And in 2019, Donald Trump, the president of the United States at the time, and also the incoming president, would be impeached by the House of Representatives for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Two separate charges. On both counts, he would be impeached. And yet he's back. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we wrap things up for the year end. We continue with our reflections throughout the year. We're reflecting on the performance of the JSE. We've got a conversation with the JSE around the markets, what's been moving, what's been happening from a deals perspective, and just overall reflections on the performance of the exchange and the constituents on the exchange. We've also got a conversation with Anchor Capital around the mining space. We're going to take a look at the performance of commodities counters, what we can expect going into the new year, some risks that might sit there. Then we've got a conversation with the editor at Currency News, Rob Rose, around that Steinhoff report. You would have heard me mention a little earlier on in the conversation with Ashraf Garda on the National Pulse that the Steinhoff report is available. It is something that can be requested, but it is seemingly rather difficult to get hold of at this stage. We're going to look at that. We're going to look at why it is important for these sorts of reports to have transparency where they relate to individuals and consumers being affected. Anyone that knows the Steinhoff story knows that a lot of people would have been affected by the happenings there. Then we've got a conversation with BP South Africa reflecting on their energy initiatives and the ever-evolving energy space. They're doing a couple of interesting, innovative things in that space going into the new year and going into their new plans as well. We're going to speak to them and see what that's all about. And then we're going to reflect on one of the conversations that was a popular conversation that we had earlier in the year was a executive lounge that we previously had. We're going to replay that because it was something that was requested from our side to replay this conversation. It was a well-loved conversation. So we're going to go back and revisit that conversation as well.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're going to start by taking a look at some of the market movements throughout the day. The market movements are getting lighter and lighter as we get closer and closer to the end of the week. I'm joined on the line by the founder at Herenia Capital Advisors, Pietri Redlinghuis, to take a look at some of the market movements throughout today and see if we can make sense of what's been happening. Good evening, Pietri. Lovely to catch up with you. For the final time this year, I suppose, markets having a bit of an offish kind of day, but nonetheless, we are still receiving data. We're still getting data out of the UK and the Eurozone around inflation, and we're expecting that CPI, the interest rate decision from the US a little later on. But sentiment clearly not wanting to do much. I mean, markets seemingly having reached the end of the year.
Jimmy, do you realize it's the first time this whole year that you haven't called me Marmalade?
I thought you wouldn't notice. How are you, Marmalade?
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
All right. It's been a weird time. If I told you that the Dow Jones finally breaks a 9-day consecutive down streak, right? Or I don't know if that makes any sense. 9 consecutive days down. It's the first time since like 1972, okay, that it's done this, that it's had 9 straight days of down. while the Nasdaq was printing new all-time highs yesterday. Would you believe me?
No, I wouldn't.
Well, it's true, believe it or not. It's the weirdest thing, man. If you look at the participation of the stocks that are making new all-time highs, it's the Magnificent Seven. If you look at the rest of the market, it is tough out there. I mean, it wasn't the ninth day. It is the 12th day in a row.
12.
That the decliners are outpacing advances in the S&P 500 as well. So only 30% of the stocks outperformed this year, and yet the market is up. If you look at the S&P 500 returns over the past 2 weeks, it's Tesla, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Meta, Avgo. They're all, you know, adding 0.8, 0.7, 0.5, and so on, 0.6, 0.2%, respectively, all together sort of totaling about just over 3.5% return between those seven. All others, minus 2.9%. Seven stocks rallying the market higher. Well, the S&P 500 has been stable over the last week. Seven stocks rallying, everyone else dying. It is the most fantastical time of the year. It's confusing. I don't understand what's going on. So, yes, it's been a bit muted. It's been a bit under pressure. But it finally looks like we have what is looking like the beginnings of a bounce on the Dow after 9 consecutive down days. So it's 12 consecutive down days. So it's been that's been a weird time.
Well, if you do need to put that into context, it is December and we do have the 12th day of Christmas. So it could be the 12 days of the Dow. You never know what could happen, right? So
I have a feeling from here it probably riff higher for the rest of the year. But I guess we'll see. There's a lot of data coming out, as you rightly mentioned. Some interest rate decisions and stuff on the cards for later. So we'll see what the Fed holds in their trick book of tricks.
At this point, Marmalade, those interest rate decisions are all but priced in. 25 basis points kind of expected. I doubt that we'll see any surprises or any shocks to the market. Are we likely to see anything happen towards sort of the rest of the week? I mean, going into next week, obviously, with it being the Christmas week and all, it's unlikely that markets will be moving much, if at all, next week. But are we likely to see any last-ditch kind of moves for the rest of this week?
So it's a bit of a confusing story. So yes, largely priced in, widely expected 25 basis points interest rate cut this evening from the Fed at 7 o'clock local time. However, UK inflation data came out and they've got an interest rate decision coming up tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. And looking at the inflation data that came out there, inflation running hotter in both the UK and in the rest of Europe. So the expectation is that has now taken the hopes of a interest rate cut in Europe off the table. Mm. And yet we've got this almost sure thing. We're going to absolutely see an interest rate cut in the US. So it's a bit like, well, we know that these two dance very close to one another. What are the chances we're going to actually see them diverge from each other? So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to expect.
And you are right. We do have that Bank of England interest rate decision tomorrow, but we also have GDP data out of the US tomorrow as well, alongside initial jobless claims and a bunch of other data points from the US's perspective. So it looks as though we are going to wrap up the week and the year on a data-heavy kind of note. And I wonder, does that then mean that markets might have a bit of an interesting start to 2025, because some of the data that we're going to see this week, a lot of the markets might not have time to fully process and fully digest. Does that then mean that we're going to be starting off the year in a busy time? Has that been the case historically?
Not really, no. So what we generally see is that the market might want to try and absorb all the news sort of in these next few days. Generally, the Santa Claus rally is actually the period between Christmas and New Year's. Mm. So we could see the market really kind of respond to and absorb information or absorb data between now and Christmas, because we still have a little bit of time next week, not a huge amount, but some. So we could have a bit of a volatile time, and then that Christmas to New Year's stretch is where it really gets quiet. And during that quiet time, you know, passive buying and that kind of stuff from index tracking funds and long-term investors and all that stuff is kind of where that bias towards the upside or that Christmas rally grind comes in, right? That's why it's this annual phenomena. And then from there, generally there's a belief, I suppose, that how the first week of the year goes, and statistically there's a bit of relevance to this as well, is how the first week of the year goes so determines the rest of the year. So if we've got a strong week in the first week, we've got an up year for the year. If we've got a down week in the first week, we're likely to have a negative year. So I guess we'll wait and see. I mean, I've been singing the same tune for a long time, which is that if you look at the seven biggest companies in the US, they are absolutely overvalued, and yet they carry on rallying, which is funny because the rest of the market is under an enormous amount of pressure, yet these Magnificent Seven stocks just keep going up and up and up and up and up. And I think that at some point this changes, and I've been saying this for a long time. I think if you remember some of the conversations we've had over the course of this year, you know, we said that there'd be a couple of things. We see interest rate cuts sort of third quarter to fourth quarter of the year. Okay, that happened. We see Trump win the election. Okay, that happened. We see the market run really hard on the back of that, the Trump victory. Okay, you could argue that that's busy happening. And then sort of halfway through next year, when people start to realize that, wait a minute, interest rate cuts are actually not positive since it's an indication of a slowing economy, then the recession kicks in. So, you know, I'll hang my hat on that for the rest of the year, I suppose, and say that I'm sticking to my original roadmap and saying we'll probably have a strong December period. We'll probably have a nice blow-off top over the first, you know, 3 to 6 months of next year, and then reality starts to set in that maybe Tesla isn't worth, you know, 500,000 times earnings.
So we are still holding on to those recession thoughts, and we'll go into the festive break with that. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Pietri. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights and for the contributions throughout the year. You and I will certainly keep in touch, and I know I'm going to be the first person that gets a message if that recession does happen, and you and I are not on the air for that. But for now, we'll leave the conversation there. Pietri Redling is founder at Herenia Capital Advisors, joining me to take a look at some of the market movements on this very light trading day, as well as some of the economic data that is expected to still come out.
Bitcoin cracked $100,000 over the last week, hitting another all-time high that pulled a ton of altcoins back to life, with some gaining 3 to 400% in a month. My name is Shivan Mudli. I'm the macro strategist at 88, and I'll be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast this week to discuss the latest developments and what's likely to happen in 2025. Please join us.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience, it's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So many of you might remember the court ruling that happened recently around the publishing or the release of certain sensitive information related to the Steinhoff saga. There was a bid put in place by Ibex Investments to prevent certain information being released, saying it would be detrimental if that information came into the public domain. The court decided otherwise, ruled against it, and some of the information is public knowledge. We have a report that was put together by the team at PwC, and that report is available for people to request should you feel that you want to take a look at that. But what it does point to is that there needs to be a lot more conversation around the transparency of these sorts of things, especially where it relates to the importance of information sharing. I'm joined on the line by the editor at Currency News and author of Steinheist, Rob Rose, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Rob. Thanks so much for taking the time. Now, I know both you and I have been trying to get hold of the report throughout the day, haven't had any luck from that respect. There are channels that you can go and apply to officially have it sent to you and all of that. But let's start with the things that we know. We know what happened with Steinhoff. We know the information that was uncovered. So then why is it that at this point a report is so mysterious?
Well, I mean, initially Steinhoff did this investigation into it PwC did this investigation, and Steinhoff said that it wanted to use the report and the findings from it, all 7,000 pages, to pursue litigation against those responsible, people like Marcus Juster and several other executives. So that's been why, ostensibly, that's Steinhoff's argument, that's why it's kept it secret until now. I'd lost the court case, as you said, a few days ago, and now agreed to give it to us.
Mm. Rob, when we look at that report, what's in the report that isn't already in the public domain? What information are we trying to protect here?
Well, there was certainly the overview, which we got a couple of years ago back in 2019, which was 11 pages, and that told you the basic overview of how much money was lost, and it was, you know, 106 billion rand over the course of 10 years. It told you who was involved. It told you the executives led by Marcus Juster. What this report will do is flesh out the chain of accountability, where the real problems happened, and I suppose say how it happened, which isn't something we actually know at the moment. So I think it'll certainly fill in many of the blanks and provide a real insight into our regulatory processes and what perhaps is not working for us, whether it's directors who aren't doing their jobs, or auditors, or internal auditors, or regulators. I think it'll point to the holes in the system that perhaps Steinhoff didn't want to release in the overview for various, I suppose, political reasons at the time.
Mm. Rob, if we are to assume political reasons at the time, what then is the reason now? So you look at the new company that's come out of the Steinhoff debacle, the Ibex Investments. They were one of the main companies opposing the release of this report. What are you then, as a company, saying is the reason or the rationale behind not wanting to have transparency?
Well, they have now agreed to give it over, so we have got it. But the point is that for many years they argued that this was legally privileged. Their argument was that they needed to go after people to recover money that was lost in this fraud, and that revealing the full extent of it and who was involved and how it worked would compromise their legal advantage. The courts disagreed. It said there's no real legal privilege in this case, and the public interest demands that this get revealed, given the fact that this was a massive fraud, our largest corporate fraud in the country. So people need to know exactly how it happened and where the problems were.
Mm. Rob, given that this is such a serious conversation and something that has been ongoing for as long as it has, what does this say about the transparency side of things and about the importance of making sure that information like this is out in the public domain, especially where it relates to public interest? So Steinhoff would have had a great public interest associated with it from the nature of its operations and the investors and all of that. What does this now say about where we need to be looking, whether we're introspecting as a country, whether it's our policies and all of that, around just having greater transparency for certain information?
Mm. You know, I think that in many cases, companies and governments, basically anyone in positions of power, when you ask them for information, their instinctive response is to say no. I think that they just like to protect information for the sake of protecting it. And often there's just no rationale for it. They just think, well, I'm not going to release it. And I think it's a stubbornness that isn't going to wash anymore. I think this reasoning in the Supreme Court a few days ago is really quite consequential, because it means that not just companies, when they have things that affect pension funds which invest in, say, Tongaat Hewlett or EOH, but even government decisions, things happen at Eskom and the government says, well, we're not going to release this report. I think now you can say, well, legal privilege doesn't apply, the public interest clearly applies, and we have an important precedent to go to these players and say to them, give us the information. I think that it'll help introduce greater transparency and hopefully make those sort of, I would say, brainless stubbornness of executives and officials in positions of power to just not doggedly just not release things. I think it'll force them to do what's in the best interest of the public, which is something that I don't think they often think about.
Mm. And I think that's such an important note that you mentioned there, Rob, around the fact that there is a public interest or a public investment in certain information, and to just withhold that information for the sake of withholding it clearly means that we need to be looking at things differently. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Rob. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Rob Rose, editor at Currency News and the author of Steinheist, joining me to take a look at the Steinhoff report and the importance of transparency that's now been placed on the report being released.
When you're growing your money, You need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best Forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're reflecting on the performance of the JSE. The JSE's had quite an interesting year, and depending on which time of the year you would have gotten involved, you may be regretting having been out of the markets. I mean, if we look at the performance of the JSE, we dipped quite low early in February, and we got as low as about 65,000 points, but we are certainly ending the year on a high note. I'm joined on the line by the head of origination and deals at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, Sam Mokorosi, to take a look at the performance of the JSE throughout the year. Good evening, Sam. Lovely to catch up with you as always. The JSE has had a busy year, whether it's your team and the deals and the originations and the listings that we've seen, the performance of the JSE. It has really been one of those years where when you compare it and contrast it to, say, the year before last year, this year was busy, but busy in a positive sense.
100%, Jimmy. I have been saying that it's been a year of two halves, really. The first half, like you mentioned, very quiet, very low volumes, lots of uncertainty in the market, lots of concerns around what elections around the world would do. And then, lo and behold, we get a GNU in the middle of the year, and government bonds have been rallying, the Rand has been rallying, the JSE All Share rallied. So it's been a really interesting time to be in the markets.
That government of national unity that you bring up, I mean, that was such a big catalyst for our own local markets. But I think also, just as you said, the general sentiment was very, very nervous coming into this year. But following the GNU, it seems as though everybody kind of wants to make a deal. Everybody's looking for something. People are putting in offers. International companies are looking to come here. You and I spoke about this last week around the increase in the number of foreign companies looking to come and list in South Africa, perhaps as secondary listings and that sort of thing.
100%.
There's just been a general interest in the South African market and the South African exchange.
No, it really is. And I think it's testament to the strong capital markets that we have, the good financial management of the economy that we see in National Treasury, in the Reserve Bank. And I think that if you compare us to other emerging markets, counterparts, I mean, we're kind of the best house in a bad neighborhood at the moment, you know. If you look at some of the challenges in the likes of Brazil, in Turkey, in Russia, investors aren't seeing many bright spots in emerging markets, especially in an environment where we're seeing the dollar being strong and the NASDAQ 100 and the S&P 500 really pumping ahead. Not many options for emerging market outperformance at the moment.
So, Sam, what are we doing right? What did we get right in this year when we also had our own elections to contend with? We also have our own myriad of problems. At some point, you and I would have spoken at the start of the year and the term load shedding would have still been a thing. Now it's not. What are we getting right then?
100%. I do think that the electricity generation, and hats off to the teams at Eskom for increasing that electricity availability significantly since the beginning of the year. I think that the availability of power, it does two things, right? It encourages industrial production, which is fantastic for the economy, but it also has a psychological effect that, I mean, we were literally in dark days and figuratively in dark days without electricity. I think that it's changed the mood, it's changed the optimism and atmosphere, and I think it's also proven to South Africans once again and to the world that, you know, you throw problems at South Africans and we will make a plan and get out of it. And so we're hoping the same will be for the water situation, which is becoming another challenge. But certainly, I think that, you know, the lack of load shedding, and then also the fact that the election didn't bring about a massive change in policy, I think that was a huge positive. A lot of people are making noise about which party is in the GNU and which party is not. But I think investors are really happy that there hasn't been a massive change in policy. And in fact, market-friendly policies are continuing to lead the way.
Sam, what do market-friendly policies look like going into the new year? What do our expectations of 2025 look like at the moment? I know you and I touched on the fact that we're expecting more deals, sure, or expecting more M&A activity, but what is there to be hopeful about for next year?
Well, so National Treasury in their October midterm budget did talk about running primary surpluses, and so that should start to see the debt burden for the state start to reduce over the next few years. I think that the market will be looking for that. I think the market will be looking for the grey listing for South Africa to get off the grey listing. I think there's an announcement in March, if memory serves me right, and hopefully a path towards ratings upgrades. I think on the inflation side, the Reserve Bank has been as conservative as always. I think that the market is looking forward to more interest rate cuts. But I think that the protectionist nature of the U.S. incoming administration is worrying the Reserve Bank. And so the rate cuts from Pretoria may come slower than what we would like. So that's something that we're looking out for. And of course, for the JSE specifically and our team, we're looking forward to companies that have been speaking about listings coming to market, giving investors more opportunity and more choice.
Sam, before I let you go, I want to take a look at those listings and the forecast going into next year. Can you give us a bit of a teaser around just how many deals are in the works? I know that your team is responsible for deals on the exchange, but also off the exchange. Can you just give us an idea or a sense of just what we're dealing with here? I mean, we've touched on the interest in South Africa, but what's the number?
So it's hard to tell. And of course, many of these are confidential, but what I can speak about is what's already been in the market. I know that Coca-Cola Bottling Africa has been waiting in the wings, making sure that their numbers shine as brightly as possible before they come to the market. Fidelity ADT has also been talking about a listing. Further out, we know African Bank, we know Time Bank have all publicly mentioned listings. So we're hoping that those will come in the fullness of time and that we won't have to wait too much longer for those. And really, we continue to hunt overseas for inward listings. You know, what's happening in the UK specifically is that UK pension funds and their investment in UK equities has been declining over the years and down to single digits percentages at the moment. And so your smaller sort of FTSE 250 companies are finding it hard to attract investor capital in the UK and finding it a bit easier in South Africa. And so we're hoping to welcome even more of those and across Europe as well.
Well, certainly going to be an interesting year going into next year, and it means that we have at least a bit of time to get our ducks in a row and prepare ourselves for the busy year that is going to be 2025, and hopefully it is a strong year, stronger than the 2024 year. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Sam. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Sam Mokorosi, Head of Origination and Deals at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, on the JSE's performance for 2024, as well as what we can potentially expect in 2025.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're reflecting on the commodities space. It's been quite a volatile year for commodities counters and commodity stocks. Commodity prices have been everywhere, left, right, center, up and down. And we're going to take a look at that and see what it means for next year and what it potentially means for how we close out this year. I'm joined on the line by commodity specialist and portfolio manager at Anchor Capital, Seleho Tsatsi, to take a look at the commodity space. Seleho, good evening. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Let's start with a reflection of the commodity space throughout the year. I mean, various commodities moving at various times throughout the year. But overall, what are your thoughts around the commodities market?
Hi, Jimmy. Great to be with you. It has been such a, say, bifurcated year for the commodity space in the sense that some parts of the market have done extremely well. If you look at things like base metals, in particular, alumina, if you look at parts of the market like PGMs, they've done incredibly poorly. Iron ore has done incredibly poorly. And then you have other parts of the market that have just been so-so. So really, depending on where you were exposed during the year, you could have had very different returns.
So now, what were some of the lagging commodities in your view throughout the year? And what were some of the ones that really stood out as the shining stars of the year?
Probably the biggest lagger and certainly one of the most important commodities to the JSE was iron ore. A large amount of the diversified miners get probably 40, 50% plus of their profits from iron ore. And that was down 25% in dollar terms this year, or at least year to date. And really, that's a China story, as we know, particularly a Chinese real estate story. So as we know, Chinese real estate has really been under pressure. Even some of the more recent data that we've gotten has continued to show prices under pressure in China, transaction volumes under pressure in China for housing. And so that has really weighed on iron ore. In terms of some of the big winners, really probably one of the ones that stands out the most just in terms of absolute performance would have to be alumina. It's a commodity that doesn't get a lot of attention because it's quite a niche commodity. Really, the company with the most exposure to it is South32. Alumina is up about 120% this year or year to date in dollar terms. So it's you know, done way better than even things like gold, which probably has gotten a lot more airtime in terms of attention. And really with alumina, it's a story around supply. We do expect that to ease in 2025, but I think that's caught the market by surprise. And then, of course, in terms of the JSE, gold has had a fantastic year. We've seen that with the performance of the gold mining shares. So gold in dollars is up about 31% year to date. And the top two performing major resource shares on the JSE this year are Harmony and Anglo Gold, which makes sense given that gold performance.
Speaking of the top performers throughout the year, Saluha, I want to take a look at some of the transactions that came through, or some of the conversations that were starting to emerge. I mean, we got a conversation from BHP expressing interest in acquiring Anglo, or at least parts of Anglo, I suppose. What did you make of the transactional activity from an M&A perspective in the commodity space?
Yeah, so I think earlier on in the year, we saw a lot of interest kind of speculation around green metals. So largely base metals, but not just base metals, but base metals along the lines of copper, nickel, zinc. These are metals that are seen as being very important to the world's transition to a greener economy. And then we've also seen, some M&A in terms of consolidation. So obviously at the tail end of last year, we saw within the PGM space, Northam, Implats, and RBPlat had that love triangle, which was resolved. And I think probably the biggest thing that we're seeing is the diversifieds are really looking to consolidate the market. Even if you look at Glencore, they spoke about potentially acquiring the assets from Teck Resources in Canada. Initially, they wanted to buy the whole business. Then they ended up buying just the metallurgical coal part of that business. But I think what we're seeing is that the large diversified companies are continuing to consolidate. And then you're seeing this theme of the green metal space play out.
When we look at that green metal space, what does that look like from your perspective going into the new year? I mean, obviously, you've alluded to metals like copper being of great interest to mining companies and potentially to manufacturers as well. What other metals are you kind of seeing in that green space, if that is to continue playing out as a trend going into next year?
So I think an interesting one has been nickel, and it's interesting for a few reasons. If you look at Anglo American's plan, they want to kind of divest several of their assets. So they want to get rid of their metallurgical coal business, their PGM business, which is Amplats. They want to get rid of De Beers, and then they also want to get rid of nickel. And the reason for that is we've seen an oversupply in the nickel market, mostly because of an excess of supply coming out of Indonesia. So nickel hasn't had a good 2024. It's down 5% in dollars this year. But what's interesting is that it is still needed within the green metal space. And you do see the likes of Glencore continuing to flag it as something that they, as a commodity that they are, they believe can do decently over the long term. So I think that'll be an interesting one to watch. Outside of that, I think PGMs are always very interesting, just given their importance to South Africa as a country. It's been a tough year in 2024 in the PGM space for a variety of reasons, but basically prices, mostly palladium and rhodium, are down significantly. And it'll be interesting to see this kind of fight between the increase in the penetration of battery electric vehicles, which is at around 12% today globally, with this decline in supply from the PGM miners in terms of actual metals produced. So that'll be an interesting space to watch as well.
Mm. So Leho, what about the risks going into 2025? I mean, off the top of my head, I'm thinking about the demand side risks that you mentioned around China earlier, but sticking with China, they announced recently some export bans on some precious metals going to the US. The trade war looks very much to be back on the cards. What are you seeing as some of the risks to the commodity space going into next year? And are there kind of factors that we, obviously some of them we might not even know of at this point, but are there factors that might have you a little more cautious around certain commodities?
Yes, as you said, China is definitely the big elephant in the room when it comes to commodity demand and commodity markets in general. China accounts for over half of demand for several important commodities like iron ore. So the state of the Chinese economy next year will be vital to watch. It was interesting. We got more signs of potential stimulus coming out of China over the last week or so. And when that initially came out, you saw the Chinese stock market react very well. And then that sort of pulled back as people are getting hesitant again about whether that's actually going to come through. So really, I would say 2025 Chinese GDP is going to be massively important. I'd say politically, we are obviously in a very sensitive geopolitical environment, and the potential for sanctions on metals or other commodities could have a very big impact on commodities going forward. Earlier this year, we saw palladium skyrocket about 20% when there were reports that the U.S. was considering sanctions on palladium metal. That ended up not happening. And obviously we've got a new US administration or presidency coming in early next year. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there in terms of potential new sanctions on any metals. So politically, there's a lot to look out for next year, and also in terms of Chinese growth.
Mm. So Leho, do you think, or do you see activity picking up on the deal side of things? I mean, we know that the likes of BHP could potentially come back to the table for Anglo once again after that mandatory period has lapsed to make bids. But around the world, we're seeing mining companies diversify, geographical locations and the like. Do you see M&A activity picking up going into next year?
I think it's a theme that will continue going into next year, Jimmy. Yes, I do think that will happen. As you mentioned, Anglo American this year had a lot of activity and interest around it. First, we had the BHP bid, but there were murmurs of other parties being interested. If you look at the major resource companies listed on the JSE, Anglo American was the third best performer after Harmony and Anglo Gold, which is interesting given that it was quite a poor year for the actual underlying commodities that Anglo is exposed to. And I think that really just speaks to the, I would say, the bid premium or the deal premium that is now in Anglo's share price. At the end of November, the six-month waiting period that BHP had to wait for before they could come in with a new bid, that period ended. So as of today, BHP can come in with another bid. General consensus is that they are likely to do so. I think the question is perhaps more around timing. So we know that Anglo, by the end of 2025, wants to look dramatically different. As I said before, it wants to divest of four of its major businesses, and that'll leave it with iron ore and copper, essentially, along with a small fertilizer or agri business. So I think Anglo is definitely a stock to watch in 2025. But speaking more broadly, yes, I do think there's going to be continued consolidation, particularly in commodities that the major diversified see as difficult to start greenfield projects in. So the likes of copper, we've seen the BHP management team talk about how, you know, it's quite difficult to just start a copper project from the ground up. And so buying rather than building seems more likely.
Certainly going to be an interesting time for the commodity space going into the new year, but we'll have to wait until that new year comes around to see how it shapes up. For now, we will take whatever wins we can. It looks as though things like the gold price might be ending the year on a high, but it is still too soon to tell because the year isn't over. But thank you so much, Selo, for the time and for the insight. Selo Hotzadze, Portfolio Manager at Anchor Capital, on the commodities space throughout 2024 and what 2025 could look like.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This conversation is brought to you by BP Southern Africa, celebrating 100 years of reimagining energy for people and our planet. In a year that's been marred by a lot of M&A transactions and activities, there's also been conversations from various parties around whether they're leaving the South African landscape or whether they're staying in the South African landscape. And along those conversations and along those lines in the energy space, BP has been celebrating 100 years of doing business in Southern Africa. I'm joined on the line by Dominic Nkatu, who is a senior manager for convenience trading at BP Southern Africa, to take a look at this and reflect on this and see what that means for the company at this stage. Good evening, Dominic. Thanks so much for taking the time. As I said in the intro, it's been a year where people in the energy space, competitors of yours, have announced that they're abandoning some of their downstream assets. They're revisiting how their businesses are shaped and they're looking at things a little differently. You, on the other hand, are celebrating. It's 100 years of doing business. It's been a long-standing relationship. How has that been for you?
Thank you, Jimmy. Good evening to you and our lovely SAFM listeners. Thank you. I'm glad to be on the call. You are absolutely correct. We are celebrating. We continue to welcome fuel staff motorists at our filling stations, really in a world that has shifted focus quite, call it pointedly, to the experience economy. The idea of convenience really in our site has really become very pertinent today. And this is what our evolution in the 100 years that we have been really doing business in South Africa has inspired us to stay. We really continue to rethink our motorist experience as well as when they need to fuel up. And if you allow me to continue as part of our celebration there, we fully understand that our customers are the driving force for really allowing us to innovate into new business models, the service platforms to deliver the convenience. You look at the mobility and the energy products and services of today and the future. Really, you start understanding that today's customer want and seek for a personalized experience, as well as wanting it now. So it's the customer of instant gratification. If you look at some of the customers really visiting our stores, some, yes, they still wish to purchase our lovely coffees, the chocolates on our hands. But we also have a broader aspect of others who their needs have really changed. They've evolved from really looking for basic. They are more into really looking for more choices. And many of these South Africans best known fuel brands have really partnered with well-established retail chains whose trusted brands and rewards programs really attract motorists to the site. So to answer your question from a BP perspective, we have really expanded. We continue to enhance our relationship with the established brands like Pick n Pay, our in-house food service, which is the World Bean. This is really to try and boost the non-fuel sales.
Mm. Dominic, you mentioned the loyalty program, and I happened to be on my way to the studio this afternoon, and I filled up at a BP, and I do have a loyalty rewards card. What are you guys doing for the loyalty program this year? I just happened to remember that I have a little green card that's sitting in my car. But what does your loyalty program look like at the moment?
Look, thank you so much. Look, thanks for really choosing BP. We really understand that the customer's needs has really changed in a very space short of time. The BPS has constantly evolved convenience offering really to suit shopper missions. So we have recently introduced the BP Rewards, like you said, which is our in-house loyalty program, which offers customers an integrated rewarding experience across fuels as well as shop. It really enables them to earn instant cash back on the purchase while you are at the forecourt, as well as really allows you to get some cash back on purchases that happens inside the store. Customers are now able to spend their cash back rewards on fuel as well as really items at a BP Express shops. And further to that, we have recognized the challenges that comes with the shopper behavior. Yes, there's no load shedding, but we also talk about the load reduction on that. We are currently piloting battery services at selected forecourts where customers can rent a low-carbon battery to help them get through such electricity interruption without really having to make a costly investment in solar panels. So they can use some of those end rewards to rent those batteries. And that really makes us being so intentional about redefining our convenience as one of those global push that makes us more interactive around how we can simplify the experience of having a customer at our forecourt.
Mm, that's such an interesting innovation, especially as we move into a more hybrid world with all the vehicles and the things around that. Dominic, before I let you go, it is the festive season. There is going to be a lot of travel taking place on the roads. What's your message to motorists or consumers that are listening over this festive period?
Look, and thanks for that, because it's important in our heart. Safety is number one priority. As we approach the holiday season, I would like to take this moment to wish all our valued customers a really joyful and safe holiday season. May this time really be filled with love, warmth, but then more so a happiness. Whether you are traveling a long or short distance, really spend some time with family, but more so reminding customers to check their vehicles before they take those long trips. For those who will be taking long trips, I will really encourage them to take a break when it matters. A long drive can be tiring, so we have developed a great offering that we believe it's sustainable enough really to carry them through until they reach their destination. So go out there, get that coffee, get that well-being a snack, and then you can nibble on your way home. Really, we would like to thank them for the past 100 years and looking for another 100 years in the near future.
Here's to another 100 years of BP Southern Africa. I think we'll leave it on that note. Be safe out there, folks. That was the message from Dominic Nkatu, who's the Senior Manager for Convenience Trading at BP Southern Africa. This conversation was brought to you by BP Southern Africa, marking 100 years of reimagining energy for people and our planet.
So how's my life been? Literally the best. With BP, it's been reward after reward. And like, can you even believe it? I get up to 30 cents per litre back when I swipe my new BP rewards and smart shopper cards for fuel. But wait, there's more. I also get 1% cash back on all my munchies at BP Express. I've been saving, like saving. It's giving ka-ching. BP, everyday brighter.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're going to wrap things up with a reflection on the conversations that we've been having throughout the year. One of the conversations that we had during the year was a very interesting executive lounge with the CEO of, for private banking or for personal private banking at Standard Bank, Funeka Monjane. Let's listen in on how that conversation was from early in the year. Wednesday, which means it's executive lounge, and we're chatting to the chief executive of private personal banking at Standard Bank, Funeka Monjane. Good evening, Funeka. Thanks so much for the time. How does one become the CEO of personal private banking, and where did you start?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to all your listeners. I hope everybody's doing well. You become the chief executive of the personal and private bank after 18 years at Standard Bank. And you do that by earning your stripes and doing almost all the jobs possible.
That's a whole school career for some people. So 18 years at one employer is certainly considered a lifetime for some. But what's been the most joy you've gotten out of this, out of the entire journey, the professional side of it, whether it's at Standard Bank or other employers? What's been the most rewarding part of this employment cycle?
You know, the last 18 years of Standard Bank for me have been joyful because the reasons why I joined remain the reasons why I stayed, which is really threefold. The first one is that when I was in my late 20s, I was a partner at PwC, and it occurred to me that, you know, a lot of our people throughout the continent, you know, are experiencing a degree of personal freedom, but we need to start talking about prosperity. We need to start actually dealing the issue around poverty and all the dignity. I know what it's like to grow up in a situation where your family is poor, you know. And I wanted to then move into financial services because I thought financial services businesses have an opportunity to play a greater role in terms of making a difference. And yeah, I joined Standard Bank because at that time, Sim Shabalala was running the retail bank, said to me, at Standard Bank, we understand that the fortunes of the bank are linked to the fortunes of the continent. So I was like, that's the one. Mm. So I think I joined because I thought I could be part of a movement that makes a difference. I thought I would work with really smart people. And I also wanted to work with a very diverse team. You know, you can imagine what corporate South Africa looked like 18 years ago. So those three reasons have kept me here and have really been... I've been happy to actually play, you know, a role in the things that are important.
Mm. I think it's such a powerful thing that you mentioned there around the financial services sector playing such a critical role in our lives in this day and age, and not coming from the wealthy background. And let's stick with that background for a second. Your X page says you're a village girl in Jozi. Where's the village? Where's the village from?
I am from the former KwaNdebele, Jimmy, which happens to be the same village as the newly appointed deputy governor of the Reserve Bank, Ms. Mampo Modise. So we come from a village that is called Vlaklach, the number one. It's about maybe 30 kilometers from KwaMhlanga, those people who know that homeland. So it was a homeland and all the expectations of a homeland about managing people's expectations about what's possible for them.
There's certainly no denying that anything is possible, and individuals such as yourself and the new deputy governor are clear evidence of that, that there are no limitations except for the ones that we set for ourselves. Funeka, I want to look at your love for art. That's quite an interesting passion. It's quite an interesting hobby that you have. I remember when I wrote a piece about art collections and just the value that exists within art, I was surprised to find and to learn all the things I did learn. Where did your love for art come from?
Interesting. I actually started collecting probably with my second or third paycheck. I think that at that time, you know, one of the earliest financial advice that I've received was that the eighth wonder of the world is compound interest. Pay off your debt as soon as possible and then choose only three things to spend money on, and hopefully one of them must be experiences, which is why I also have a big love of travel. So I had to choose the other two. I realized, thankfully, I don't know if this is the right thing or not to say, I'm not into cars. So that means I have a lot of money that I can spend on other things if I'm not buying cars. I mean, I was driving a Prius, a black Prius that I bought for $180,000 for like 10, 15 years. That meant then that I had capacity. And I love art. For me, I think art is, you know, in a way, it's strange that you can buy art because ownership of art is not really a thing. Art belongs to the nation. And I'm quite passionate about African art remaining in African hands as much as we are global as well. And so I'm hoping that, you know, the little collection that I've built one day will not be sold and some of it will be in its rightful place, which is for people. So
we're going to leave that conversation there. If you want to catch up on that conversation, it is up online, as we have all our conversations up online. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. We are going to get ready to cross back to the SAFM news team. Greg Hose is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. Tomorrow night is going to be the final episode of the market update for the year 2024. So tune in for that episode. But for now, it's just gone 7 o'clock. So I'm going to have to say goodnight, but I'll speak to you tomorrow. For now, good night.